Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kane and Rince podcast. It's volume 13, issue 607, and today we're talking about Castlevania Rondo of Blood. And joining me, Leon Cox, in this issue, we've got Leah Haidu.
I was told we were doing an anime game today, so I showed up.
Definitely anime. Michiel Kroder.
I'm taking a deep breath, and I was going to do Richter's Death Scream, but it's just not fresh enough in the memory anymore.
It's not coming.
Afraid I have to disappoint. I do remember it being overly dramatic, though.
We'll edit it in post, as they say.
Perfect.
Yeah. What a letdown. And also, Richter Davison, welcome.
Oh, wow, okay. Death to you! The world is not yours to exist in!
Yeah.
That's my favorite line from the game.
Nice. Well done. Now say it in German.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Or Romanian. Okay. So those of you who listen to the Kane and Rince podcast will recall that we've been working our way through the vintage Castlevanias. We haven't done every single game because there's been some that have been like spin-offs or particularly conversions thereof. And this show will also include a couple of variations of the game we're covering, which is Akumajo Dracula X Chino Rondo, known in the West, even though it didn't get a release outside Japan for quite some time. Is known as Castlevania Rondo of Blood, which is the 10th main game in the Demon Castle Dracula series, a side-scrolling 2D horror-themed action platformer. At this point, the Rondo part of the title is written with kanji, Chinese characters, in the Japanese version. These are usually pronounced Rinna or Rin, I'm not sure. This word is a transliteration of the Chinese Yunhui, which in turn is a translation of samsara, a Sanskrit word referring to the circle of reincarnations in Buddhism, as opposed to nirvana. A rondo, however, is a musical form in which the main theme repeats itself several times during the course of a movement. It can be therefore seen as the musical equivalent of the philosophical term. Thanks, Moby Games. All right, so histories could be interesting with this one because it's not a game that any of us probably would have had access to when it first launched. So, Leah, where did your Rondo journey begin?
Yeah, So Rondo, properly, I didn't play until the PS, I guess it was a PS4 version came out with paired with Symphony of the Night. But I had played some of it before with the PSP Dracula X version. So I'm not sure what year that would have been, but I was already pretty into Castlevania by that point. So yeah. I don't know that I necessarily realized it was a version of a game that had already existed for some time. But I did pick it up on the PSP and, you know, played through some of it there. I don't think that I finished it at the time because, it's not the easiest game unless you're playing as Maria, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But, I think the main attraction for me on that one was actually that you could unlock what actually turned out to be a pretty bad version of Symphony of the Night. So I played that version then. I played the remastered version, the Rondo version from the PS4 remake when that came out alongside Symphony, which I played a bunch of times. And then I played through it again for this recording. So haven't played it through too many times, but I've played a couple of different versions.
Nice. Michiel, what about yourself? Were you aware of this when it was an import-only title back in the early mid-90s?
I was, I saw it in American magazines because they had the TurboGrafx over there, of course.
Yeah.
The TurboGrafx CD. And it was featured in EGM, which I bought every now and then. I bought a copy of it because I never thought the writing was particularly great, but they were just very thick, full of interesting ads and a lot of screenshots. Absolutely. So it was just like good consumption for looking ahead, like what games would come out, and it looked really cool, you know, like Castlevania. So I've been into the series since the very first part, so that naturally piqued my interest. It never came out in the US, as we very well known, of course. Mm-hmm. And kind of fell off my radar a little bit. But then by the time it was announced or, pretty much released for the Wii Virtual Console, I jumped on it.
And here you are.
And here I am. And
having mastered it.
Not really. The thing is, like,
me neither.
It's very funny, like, because I bought a lot of Wii Virtual Console games, and I've played a lot of them over time as well. But it was always like, oh yeah, let me just fiddle around with this game for a little while, or fiddle around with that game. So I never did a full on playthrough, even though what I played was always very enjoyable. Yeah. I remember in Chino Rondo that. There were usually, it was pretty smooth sailing until I had hit some difficult part or some difficult boss on one of the paths that I chose. And then, gave it a couple of tries. But since I wasn't really invested enough to where I wanted to see it all the way through, I just figured like, I'll do it someday. I'll just
why we're here.
Grit my teeth and sit down and play all the way through. And that's what I did recently for this podcast.
Yeah. It's what it's all about. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Rich, how about you? Have you? I can't recall which of the other Castlevania shows you've joined us on.
Yes, this is how I was going to introduce it. This is my first Castlevania show.
I thought it might be.
Yeah. It's interesting as a series, not one I'm especially invested in terms of like actually feeling like it's a formative series for me. But I've definitely played a lot of them. It's just that none of them seem to sort of resonate terribly well on the Metroidvania scale. I like to think of myself much more on that Metroid side rather than the Castlevania, but nonetheless, generally have quite a good time with Castlevania. Like Leah, I first played Rondo of Blood in the Castlevania Requiem Collection in 2017. So it was 18. packaged in with Symphony of the Night. It's always been difficult to kind of boot up Rondo in that regard because I go there for Soten and I kind of stay there for Symphony of the Night and I'll maybe dabble once or twice and make sort of incremental progress. But it's weird. I'm not sure if I'd played Rondo through emulation prior to this. And that's probably because of the way that it shares so much of its DNA with Dracula X on the Super Nintendo, a game that I definitely have played before. So a lot of those memories have kind of transposed and it's difficult to parse the two, but having gone back to play it recently, I now know there's a kind of critical difference between the two. What have I played? So I've done Rondo with Richter. I've done it with Maria. I've done the Four Maidens ending. I've done Dracula X Chronicles today just to try and sort of get a sense of what's going through there. And I was going to go this afternoon and play Dracula X on the Super Nintendo, but thought better of it because that's maybe a bit too much Castlevania in one day for me. So yeah, pleased to be here. Hopefully not the last time on a Castlevania show.
Yeah, sure. We'll talk a little bit about the Super Nintendo game later on. As for my history, I was definitely aware of it, although I remember being confused when I first played Symphony in 97 or 98, whenever I started it. And the opening stage was the final stage of another game. And because I'd also at that point never played the Genesis version, and because that Mega Drive, that was known as Bloodlines, when it said Bloodlines, I was confused because I thought it was the end of that game, but actually it's not. It's the end of Rondo. Confusing stuff. It makes sense once you've actually played all of Rondo. And I completed Symphony to the point that I unlocked Richter as a playable character. Which makes it back into a slightly more traditional Castlevania game after a fashion. I picked up the Rondo of Blood Wii Virtual Console release when that happened, and very similar to Mikhail, stuck it on, played a bit, and then when meeting resistance, which this game does offer up, not the most of any game in the series, but plenty enough, I would probably switch over to something else for a bit more accessible fun. Then bought it again with the Requiem double pack that we'll reference. And again, similar really, hadn't really played it properly up until the run up to this show. But the version that I've actually played the most and completed is the ROM on the PC Engine Mini, which is a nice little mini console that did get a release in various territories with various lineups of games, and in among the Japanese games is Rondo of Blood. So yeah, that's the one I've played the most. But since completing that one, I've been on the PS4 version trying to, because it's actually it's a tougher ask, because the PS4 version, unlike many sort of retro re-releases, doesn't feature much at all in the way of helpers, so no save states or rewinds or anything like that. So I've been working my way through trying to find all the stages and all the alternate paths and everything like that, so right up until this very day, because yeah, there's a lot you can miss in this game, as we'll discuss. Developed and published, of course, by Konami and directed by Toru Hagihara, who I think only has three design credits, according to Mobi Games, which is this and Symphony of the Night, and also Metal Slug 5 later on. The Neo Geo was a sub-director on that game. The thing I notice looking through the creative team for this game is that more of them had worked on Gradius 2, Gofer no Yabo, or Vulcan Venture than had worked on any previous Castlevania games, which is interesting. But I suppose I speculated that it might have made sense in the sense that the arcade hardware they were working on for that was considerably more powerful than a lot of machines around at the time at home. And when there was a project for the PC Engine is a hybrid 8 and 16-bit machine, I believe. 8-bit CPU, 16-bit graphics. Is that right, Mikhail?
Yeah. It's kind of a hybrid, kind of stuck in between, yeah.
So sometimes you'll see it referred to as an 8-bit console and other times a 16-bit, but it's somewhere between the two. And obviously this CD add-on gave it new storage capabilities and all the bells and whistles. So maybe it made sense in that regard, in that if you listen to the soundtrack on Gofer no Yabu, it sounds way more like kind of real instruments than chip tunes than in previous games. And and it's possibly just who was free at Konami at the time. There is one particularly interesting credit for me, and will resonate with other fans of the legendary Winning 11 or Pro Evolution Soccer series, because one of the coders on Rondo of Blood was Shingo Takatsuka, better known as Seabass, who is, for those of us who are playing a lot of football or soccer video games in the 2000s, something of an icon and legend. It was released for the PC Engine Super CD-ROM in Japan on October the 29th, right before Halloween 1993, so just over 30 years ago. That Wii Virtual Console version arrived in April 2008 in Japan, and then not until March 2010 in the rest of the world.
And I think March was usually the what they would call the Hanabi Festival.
That's right.
Yeah,
it was really cool.
Yeah.
Were you at Nintendo at this point?
By 2010. Oh yeah. I was there for 2 years at this, or 1.5. Yeah.
Yeah. Hanabi festivals were always fun. It meant that we got some releases of games that had never come out west before.
And, yeah.
Much more normal now, but back then it was like a real treat.
Yeah, pretty exciting at the time.
Robin Enrico is our first correspondent from our Patreon. Robin says, a game that loomed so large and yet lived up to the hype. I spent years in the 90s trying to get a TurboGrafx CD and even a burnt copy of this game to no avail. Struggled with janky emulators and keyboard controls. Then the game's release on PSP in 2007 is what got me to purchase said system. I've never returned to that 2.5D version, having completed it, as the visuals are so flat in comparison to the immaculate sprite art of the original, but I am fascinated with it as a technical dead end. The remake plays superbly, suitably snappy, and does add in some extra bonuses and storyline surprises for players who fully explore it, but the only thing we would see like it was Mercury Steam's Mirror of Fate 6 years after. Unlike that game, the PSP version of Rondo felt like Konami making an earnest effort at finding a new way forward instead of throwing a bone to entrenched Castlevania players. I'd hoped we would see more remakes of the older Castlevanias or even a new entry in the series in this form from Konami, but I am glad they finally took the chance on this one, as it serves as an interesting take on the material brought the original to the West and serves as the base for the recent PS4 port.
Throwing a bone, that's a very Castlevania sort of way of expressing yourself.
So that PS4 version, Requiem with Symphony of the Night, arrived worldwide October 2018. So even that is over 5 years old at this point. Still available on the PlayStation Store and playable on your PS5. And you get Symphony of the Night, which is a game that we've covered before a long, long time ago and were quite enthusiastic about. Psycho Hype from our forum says, "It's hard for me to point to anything this game does wrong or out of step in building from the foundation of the original NES trilogy. I can hardly think of a game that exudes more confidence than this one, an attitude perfectly encapsulated in the character of Richter Belmont, who arrives on the scene in the opening montage, takes one steely look at the opposition, and starts cracking skulls. The sprites are gorgeous, the level design is impeccable, and the music is quite possibly my favourite in the series. The fact that Konami managed to squeeze in an entirely separate set of secret levels on top of the main path just blows my mind. That is true replay value. If I'd known about or had access to this game as a kid, it's entirely possible my spirit would have evaporated from my body and gone straight to heaven. I'm just glad that the game was eventually released in North America, and if you have a PS4 or a PS5, the Castlevania Requiem Collection is a great way to give this masterpiece a go." PC Engine Mini, I think the game is on all three versions. I'm not even sure if the games actually change per region because it's got some Japanese and some American titles on it, even on my European one. March 2020, May 2020, and June 2020 for the different regions for the PC Engine Mini with its various different names. Reviews back in the day, Famitsu gave it 28 out of 40. So I think, is that 2 8s and 2 7s? No, that's not right. Okay, 4 7s? Yeah, could be 4 7s.
Yeah.
Something like that. So not absolutely stellar, which is perhaps surprising given the reputation of the game.
Mm.
Game Fan gave it 391 out of 400. Was that four reviewers each giving a percentage maybe or something like that?
It would have to be, right? Otherwise, that's a weird number.
A very weird number.
Yeah.
Based on that one example from each territory, we can see that maybe it was Game Fans American, right? So
yeah,
it was perhaps better received in America than it was in its native Japan, where it came out.
Where it actually came out, yeah.
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 Wii Virtual Console obviously saw the game get some re-reviews, and IGN gave it a 9 out of 10. Nintendo Life gave it a 9 out of 10. And the average review score across both the original era and the re-release era, according to Moby Games, is 91%. But it's the kind of game that I think actually almost has a sort of that sort of aura around it, that a reputation that grew and grew on the video game internet forums of the 2000s. Certainly in my memory, it's the kind of game that would be spoken about in sort of hushed tones, or, and maybe there was an element in that of the kind of hipster about it, because it was a game that, you know, perhaps not everybody knew because it was Japanese only, and it was on a machine that hadn't sold nearly as many units as the Sega and Nintendo machines. So I think there was a certain amount of kind of, yeah, I know best, Rondo of Blood, that's the one.
Yeah, like the scarcity kind of did it favors. Not being able to disprove some of the stuff that's in there and just sort of listening to the reviews at the time. I can see that. I can see that becoming kind of a bit of a, almost like a cult following in that regard.
Very much. Yeah. That's my recollection anyway. User reviews today, or at least they've been recorded up to this point. Moby Games has 8.3 out of 10, and Nintendo Life has 8.8 out of 10 from 99 folks, which is a pretty strong score. Sales-wise, absolutely not a clue. Nothing anywhere that I could find on units sold. Mr. Ixolite from the forum says, "When I started a Castlevania series playthrough years ago, I didn't know Rondo of Blood existed. Eventually, I picked up from internet chatter that it was supposedly the secret best game in the series, a sort of hipster's choice." Sorry for preempting you there, Mr. Ixolite. "And when I used an emulator for a console I'd barely heard of to boot up a Japanese ROM that leads with an inexplicably German cartoon intro about a Romanian vampire hunter, It felt like the gaming equivalent of having come across an obscure bootleg VHS movie from a yard sale. The first impression is strong as the game leads with a dramatic prologue which gives way to the rocking sound of divine bloodlines and sumptuous sprite work. You quickly face off against monsters that could have served as bosses in prior games, and it feels like the Rondo mission statement was to be a beginning-to-end thrill ride, and for my money it succeeds. While Richter is less capable than Super Castlevania IV's Simon with his super dangly whip, he feels the opposite courtesy of his cool item crashes, backflip, and the next-level audio-visual presentation surrounding him. Everything is just a bit cooler now, like the bosses that try one last-ditch effort to kill you before they dramatically expire. This is the game where you fight Death at the top of a wrecked pirate ship, where he eventually swaps his stylish new robes for a ragged cloak as he gets serious and eventually gets beheaded by his own scythe, and it's just so cool. It's not the spectacle that makes Rondo special, but it's also its elaborate approach to the classic linear Castlevania design. To wit, Rondo is not the first Castlevania to feature branching paths or recruitable characters, but rather than presenting these up front on the critical path, Rondo hides them away. You need to poke at the corners of Rondo's levels, find keys to cages, maybe even solve small puzzles, and get rewarded with chunks of more game, rather than hearts or sub-weapons. I still remember the thrill when I casually whipped a wall in level 1 in search of wall meat, only to be greeted with an entirely new area and boss to fight. Delightfully, this is the case for most levels in the game. It even features multiple endings, a trope more associated with the Metroidvania era of the franchise, which this game sows a lot of seeds for. Facilitating exploration is the fact that you can freely choose stages and characters from the main menu, a modern convenience that absolutely wasn't a given at the time. If you miss Maria or one of the maidens, you don't have to replay the whole game from scratch. Rondo is simply all vampire killer, no filler, the Mirror Sheen polished version of the series' original template. It's the ultimate rendition of what about it had appealed to me to begin with, a colourfully gothic rock opera roller coaster featuring the MVPs of the Universal Monsters. And for that reason, it is my favourite Castlevania. So timeline-wise, we're in the middle-ish of the Castlevania opus, I guess. We're after the Belmonts, Trevor, Christopher, Simon, Joost, and then we're at Richter. So he's the forgot Leon. Sorry, of course, of all the ones to forget. And then before the Morrises and all that. The official manual description has it that in the good old days, the people desired only prosperity and peace, and certainly everyone thought that the days of unrest would surely never come. But on the other side of peace and prosperity, there invariably exists evil. Rejecting the people's prosperity, they corrupt the peace. Those who sought to restore the powers of evil and remake this corrupt world gathered. Smiles crept across their faces as their expectations for the coming Genesis swelled. After 100 years, a being of evil once again returned. This man could change his form into that of a bat or wolf or mist, particularly favouring to act at night. Sucking the blood of young women, he retained eternal life, master of the demon castle, god of the wicked. Count Dracula has returned. I mean, that's all I need to know. Yeah. I only need the last line of that. I mean, it's all good flavour. But yeah, oldie times guy goes into castle with whip. Beyond that, I don't know. Has anyone, since we've been doing this series, like, has anyone dived into the well of Castlevania lore and mythos?
I've looked at it a little, but I mean, it's in the same way that I look at, like, I was going to say Kingdom Hearts, that's a bad example. But yeah, in the same way that you would look at, like, the, maybe Zelda is a better, a better comparison, because for me, at least, because I find it interesting. I think it's neat. And I think that most of this is retrofit to the games that they made, which is fine. I mean, these games typically are not, they don't hinge on their mythology. You know, what you come to them for mostly is going to be the gameplay and all of that. But it's fun to me to see kind of how they, now, could I tell you what the whole, absolutely not, but no. I can tell you that Maria in Rondo is the same character as Maria in Symphony, and it's kind of weird and a little bit creepy because she appears to be wearing the same dress in both of them, but
She has grown up a little bit in Symphony.
Yeah, that's why it's bad that she's wearing the same dress, because I'm pretty sure you should have changed that by now a little.
Yeah.
So I was actually thinking about this, because I don't believe I've played a Castlevania prior to this that's kind of go into the kind of what ifs of like humanity and all of that sort of good stuff. And
yeah,
when you listen to some of the videos, I don't even know if that's the right word.
Yeah,
but
they
the
were
cutscenes.
FMV off the CD. Yeah,
yeah, the kind of fascist ruminations of Dracula that go on in there is quite interesting, really. He's a very, like, you know, pontificating on, like, noblesse oblige and all that sort of good stuff. So it's asking some pretty interesting questions, just weirdly in a game that you wouldn't have expected it to come from. I liked it, though.
Yeah, and like you said, Leon, you mentioned it already, flavor. Flavor is important. What if it was only go in castle, defeat evil monster? You know, that's a little bit too standard, maybe. And they did sow the seeds of a slightly more involved narrative, of course, in this game, with Symphony of the Night being a sort of a direct sequel to this. And having a little bit more depth and indeed flavor to the characters in the setting.
And also, maybe it speaks to, obviously, we spoke going right back to the original game. It was always designed to be this sort of cinematic thing. Even the early Castlevanias, which came out before Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, with the film reel motif.
Exactly. And the credits and all that. And here, obviously, the CD allowed them to basically, make an anime, albeit one with not tons and tons of scenes or frames of animation, but it has speech, it has some animation. And if you complete the game with Maria, for example, you get basically a comedy, like a cartoon, total silliness with cutesy anime girl and cutesy animals running away from the castle. All that
Even
sort of
just
thing.
Playing so, with her is a little bit goofy comedy mode, you know?
Very
if you
much
die,
so,
also you get these sort of magnetic fridge letters. All colorful saying game over and... Yeah.
Yes.
I must admit, I'm not terribly au fait with the series prior to this, to be honest with you, but it does seem to kind of, at least to me, mark the kind of switch between that kind of, you know, that kitsch Hammer horror style approach to Castlevania to what we now know to be what is ostensibly the Castlevania lore all the way up until the recent sort of anime release on Netflix. It seems as though a lot of that lore has kind of been established in and around this time.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if, like in an ideal world, if they'd had the tech going back in the Famicom era, would they have? Was this what they always wanted to do at Konami? Kind of expand it in this way with animated cutscenes and all the stuff that they just couldn't do on a cartridge. But I guess
maybe. But there's a definitive different sort of art direction about Rondo of Blood, where it definitely leans way more into anime and anime styled. Action as well.
Yeah,
and, you know,
and
character renditions.
As we've already established, this game was actually made by, although you can feel a lot of, even the way the sprites look and move and the mechanics of the game feel very familiar, having played a lot of games prior to this, this is largely a different team making this game.
Yeah.
So, voice cast in place. I imagine some of them would have been familiar for those listening to or watching Japanese anime back in the 80s. The narrator is who does the German is, as far as I can work out from the name, German, Hans Gunther Claude. But sadly, that's Hans's one and only credit. I was hoping to find, like, he was in the films of Werner Herzog or something like that, but no.
He does have a impressive narration voice, you know, with the compression of the older technology and all that taken into account. Yeah, so I don't know. It doesn't sound completely like they just plucked a German person off the streets and put him in the recording booth.
He's like an advert guy or something. I don't know.
It does sound like someone with a little bit of voice acting acumen, at least.
He was probably based in Japan, I guess, because they wouldn't have flown somebody in just for that.
The one
probably.
German guy in Japan that
they could find. Could have been. In 1992, probably.
Yeah.
Richter is voiced by Jin Horikawa, and Maria is voiced by Yaku Tepozuka. Tolkien, from our forum, who I believe is a separate person from Tolkien Taters, confusingly. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think you are distinct humans. Tolkien says, I didn't play the real original Rondo of Blood until 5 years ago when I got a PC Engine Duo R for my collection. So I played all the other games of the series, and this is the last I completed. And now I understand the gap between Classicvania and the Egervanias. This video game was the pivotal point for the ones that come after. The graphics look very polished and beautiful for the time. There are some new effects. There's some effects that blew my mind knowing this was released back in 93, like the spinning picture boss fight effect. The cutscenes with voice actors and wonderfully animated sprites, so charming and well done that those have been used to this day in 8 other later games of the series that I can count. Gameplay is back to its roots, hence some sections are hard. I must say I did not get why they changed the omnidirectional whip controls from Super Castlevania 4, and we never had that again. Graphics are awesome with a colourful palette and well-animated sprites, while the music is just perfect. An absolute must for any Castlevania lover. Well, let's get into the visuals. So, as I say, 8-bit CPU, but 16-bit graphics. I think the visually, the games on the PC Engine were... You could tell them apart from Super Nintendo games, and they were probably closer to Mega Drive in terms of the amount of colours available and resolutions and stuff, but still, they did have their own look.
Yeah. There were some technical limitations to the type of hardware set up to where, for example, PC Engine games couldn't do parallax scrolling backgrounds natively unless they used some kind of trickery, you know, which... You do see in Rondo of Blood, like they did pull some tricks there to get it to look like parallax scrolling, or maybe the added hardware of the Super CD ROM gave them that boost a little bit as well. But yeah, it was you did tend to see some limitations in PC Engine games, but despite that, the system really had a lot of strength as well. It could throw a lot more at the screen, you know, just on a base level, without slowing down as much as many a Super Nintendo game did, for example.
Yeah, that's really prevalent in that first level as well, the path through the woods where you get, it doesn't feel like orthodox parallax, but you certainly get that sense of speed as you're in the back of that carriage kind of burning through the woods. It's really impressive.
Yeah, that looks like different parts of the background sort of being animated at and scrolling at different speeds or something like that. Yeah, but a very very efficient or a very effective way of conveying that.
I think the thing that I find the most striking about just kind of the art design in general is that it feels a lot more colorful than some of the other games in the series, and along with that, so we're coming off of, not directly, but we're coming off of Super Castlevania 4, which has really big sprites, but they don't feel maybe as mobile a lot of the time as some of the sprites in the other games in the series. And here, I think that the sprites look great. Like they are really well designed. They're pretty big, and they don't really lose any of that maneuverability that I think is kind of key to having a Castlevania game that feels like it plays well.
Yeah, you're right. There's typically more animation frames to the sprites as well, and and the art direction is so strong that of course they would reuse a lot of the sprites in this game. In this game, in later installments in the series, in the Metroidvania ones, you know, like they didn't reuse the Super Castlevania 4 Medusa heads, but they did reuse the Rondo of Blood Medusa heads, for example.
Anything else on the visuals side? Any favorite stages or effects or touches?
I kind of jokingly mentioned the anime bit, which we've talked about a little bit. The death boss fight, the second, I guess, technically death boss fight, which one of our correspondents had mentioned, that is one of the most anime presentations of death that I can think of, because you know, you get your initial stage where he's kind of doing what we've seen this before, right? Like you're in a different place. You're on this pirate ship, but he's floating around and he's throwing sighs at you and you have to avoid them. And yeah, this is all very familiar. And then he floats back into the background, comes back, does like a Yakuza shirt rip with his with his cape or his outfit, and then just starts dueling you basically. And I think that's pretty memorable.
Just like death in real life.
Yes, yeah, of course. Exactly. Famously so. The level names are kind of a little bit of a blur to me because they don't quite follow and they're different depending on whether you're playing as Maria or as Richter. But in the second stage, God grant me strength, when you're fighting the werewolf at the end of that level, it's really cinematic. There's a lot going on. You kind of sees in the background, transforms into a werewolf, jumps into the fray, you battle him, and then he bursts into flames at the end before resuming his human form. It's really impressive. It is quite kind of, it's a journey that you're taking on rather than just phasing in, fading out, and then moving on to the next thing, you know?
Yeah, a few of the bosses do that sort of grand entry, or you see them lurking in the background before they enter the stage.
Yeah. Overall, just really consistent, you know? There's not too many areas in the game that look underwhelming or weak. And there's always, depending on the paths you take, there's always something interesting or some interesting boss creature to fight.
So audio-wise, we've got the power of the CD-ROM. So we've got some, as well as some speech and acting, we've got some vocal samples, which Mikkel bottled out of giving us at the start.
I dug that.
We've also got some more traditional video gamey sounds and noises, which are long been something that we've been praising about this series from the 8-bit stuff, where Konami's sound team was so creative with such limited noises. Now we've got stuff which sounds more 90s, I guess.
Yeah, and this isn't yet another thing about this game that really threw me off when I first started playing it. By all accounts, the way this game looks, you'd think like it would be chiptunes galore, you know, with the graphic fidelity of it. But then all of a sudden you have this sort of like much higher quality, faux life instrumentation playing in the background. And I felt like I turned off the game sound and had turned on a CD or something.
Yeah,
like
it's a weird thing.
It didn't
feel
coherent, coherent initially when I started playing.
I agree. And while it's actually great to, you know, finally hear some of those iconic tunes reworked and remixed and rearranged in this game, I totally agree. And I still find that playing in whatever format I'm playing PC Engine CD games, there is this sort of slight disconnect between the audio track. And it's weird that I don't feel it so much with the PS1 and Saturn era stuff, even though the same issue.
Because this feels more like, somewhere in between an 8 and 16-bit. Yeah, sure. More 16-bit title, I guess.
The game still looks like a previous gen. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely not 32-bit, you know? It doesn't look it goes all the way there.
That's true.
That is what causes the disconnect for me.
It is a dearly beloved OST, though. And do we have fans, Rich?
I was just going to say, like, when I was listening to it, I'm not, again, terribly kind of familiar with exactly what mechanically is going on with the CD. But when I was listening to it, I definitely got that kind of 1980s Yamaha DX7 style, like MIDI sample file of everything that was going on. I tend to associate Castlevania with like that Mega Man style, like prog rock soundtrack. So like, you know, Bloody
There's
Tears.
There's some great prog in this game.
Yeah. This feels more like sampled music to me, almost like sort of Japanese like city pop rather than rock.
Yeah, it's definitely poppy, but I mean,
not
there are
ding, of course.
There's no, and obviously later on we get some more kind of cinematic horror kind of stuff as well. But yes, guitar solos from Motoaki Furukawa,
who gets a name in the credit, which is incredible, like straight up there. guitar solo by, you know, that's how you know it's
on a technical level, Rich, it's just playing the music off the CD. They recorded it in a studio with instruments, and you're hearing it played back off the CD. There's nothing more to it than that. The game sound is coming out the console.
So it probably was made on a Yamaha DX7 totally. In that
absolutely.
Case.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have been recorded by the sound team, the musicians who composed it. I imagine there would have been some samples in there. Yeah. And yeah, as you say, using Yamahas or whatever.
There's some samples that are in there that I've definitely heard. And I was trying to remember, like, where have I heard this used in like a Prodigy game. Song or something like this somewhere down the line, you know? usually like a sound effect of some sort. But yeah.
Yeah. But they loved their orchestra stabs, their gank at this era. There's some of that, less so in Castlevania than in their scrolling beat 'em ups and things like that.
Yeah.
I think my favourite tune is the one when you're in the sort of sky level, which is ridiculously proggy. You've got this whole kind of mad Rick Wakeman type sort of solo, keyboard solo in that one. And obviously there are reworkings, of at least three tracks from earlier games, the producers of which aren't actually, the writers of which aren't credited in the game originally, but mean.
It feels like a soundtrack of a time, though. Like, I listen to this and I'm like, yeah, this feels like kind of 90s. There's like a lot of syncopation of different like beats that you would have heard in the 8-bit version, just slightly different and more jazzy and a little bit more upbeat. Which is kind of a weird one. Certainly playing through the beginning of the game puts me in mind of like very early Nintendo games where you'd have that. I think we talked about this in the Metroid shows. You would have like a very uplifting kind of initial song, followed by much more kind of atmospheric and moody songs as you go through. And that seems to be like a theme that you got here. It's very listenable, which is maybe not a great observation, but that's the one that I've got.
Is this a good time to mention that McKeel and I have done some specific recording on the soundtracks to Castlevania games, including this one?
Yeah, you should.
I just mentioned that.
So quite some time ago, you made a Castlevania-themed Sound of Play for us, which is still available.
Which would have been the one that this specific game would have been included on.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you can check that out. But you've recently kind of made a sequel for somebody else.
Yeah. With my friend Peter Scheffer, who's been on the Psychonauts 2 episode with you as well.
Yeah.
And he cleverly titled the episode of his Knights of the Retro Table podcast Requiem of Play as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Seek it out, listener.
Yeah, it was a really good time. I recommend.
I'll bet. So into the gameplay, Psycho Hype from our forum says the game is certainly challenging, especially if you decide to continue through the whole game as Richter. But it's a surmountable challenge, one that can definitely be met with a little time and patience. The boss battles are another standout in this regard, particularly the boss rush that is Stage 6. And if you get to the point where you can clear all the levels from start to finish on one credit, it's an awesome feeling. Let's start, as usual, with the sort of the general feel of controlling the characters in this one. I would say it's familiar, but having come off the back of both some of the Game Boy games, which perhaps weren't so successful in getting that classic Castlevania feel, and the Super Nintendo game, which kind of went for a slightly different overall feel, this to me feels like the kind of the apex of where you could get to with the original basic setup of jumping Whippy Man in 2D platform environment.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes, and if you look at the rest of the lineage of the series, of course, later this year, we're going to be talking about Bloodlines, aka the new or the next generation. And then the Metroidvania Castlevanias also typically don't have much else in the way of a binary sort of attack. You know, you press the button and your weapon swings out. So it makes Super Castlevania 4, as we discussed last year, almost feel like more of an outlier and a sort of a spin-off remake game almost than the other Castlevania games. And I was a little bit disappointed, like the correspondent earlier, that I couldn't whip in multiple directions anymore, like I could in Super Castlevania 4. So in a sense, this sort of throwback to just swinging your, you know, swinging your whip back and then swinging it forward, and that being the extent of your main attack, felt almost more like like a full on realization of the 8-bit Castlevania games.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned when I was talking about the actual just character designs, but it's Richter here. He looks like Richter in Symphony of the Night, because I mean, I'm assuming they're probably using the same sprite, but he's just not as thick with maybe two C's as we saw in Super Castlevania 4. So he just feels better to move. And I think that's probably also related to what McGill was saying about the extra frames of animation, and he feels maneuverable in a way that that maybe was starting to get lost a little bit. And I appreciate that. And then there's Maria, which oh boy, she's got some motion on her.
She's got moves. She can even control moves. Her a bit in air. She can attack while she's running.
She can do a double jump.
She can dash on her tummy.
Throw a tantrum sort of while throwing a tantrum.
The same though. But I think honestly, what got me, what I think makes Maria the almost easy mode character is that her standard attack has a little bit of tracking on it. So when you're throwing out those little birds that she uses to attack, those are super useful for things like flea men and bats and like just the little annoying enemy birds, the little annoying enemies that
things are on the things that are on the level above you, things that are behind you. Yeah, so she really does make the game. It's sort of weird because the game portrays her in this very kind of cliched, stereotypical anime. She's meant to be like 12 or something, and she's goofy and she's high pitched and she's squealy and she's super girly and, you know, in all the traditional ways. But of course, she's actually way more kick ass than Richter. Like, she really, really owns this game in a way that Richter can't hope to because of her extra maneuverability. She isn't fully committed to her jump. Things like that, you can actually steer her in the air and stuff like
you
that.
You do have a little bit of maneuverability with
a
Richter.
Little, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You have the neutral jump as well, which is like a shortened jump, which is actually not terribly helpful in most circumstances, but is circumstantially very useful to do.
Do you mean the backflip?
Well, you can jump and then press a direction after jumping, very slightly after, and you'll do a much smaller arc, which is somewhat helpful. It's been a while since I played Super Castlevania, but is this the first instance of where your jump is potentially, you know, you can redirect your inertia after jumping? Or?
Super Castlevania 4 has that as well.
Super Castlevania 4 has it more so. It felt more modern, whereas this has some kind of concessions to that idea, but is fundamentally is very obviously a sequel to the NES game Castlevania 3, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It feels almost like that. I thought like, it looked at Super Castlevania 4 and felt like, no, this is just taking it too far. You know, let's take a couple of steps back. Let's rein it back in a little bit.
Yeah. Richter is very framey, which is not a great descriptor, but like you commit to sort of completing every single one of those frames before you can recover your movement, which makes him very stodgy. And I know that's emblematic of previous Castlevanias
very much so, yeah.
But there's no frame cancellations with the exception of the backflip, for example. And the backflip is incredible, but also like very difficult to master to be able to get that backflip jump. And there's several different heights that you can backflip at as well, which makes it not a consistent.
What always puzzled me was that the backflip felt like such a incredibly circumstantial and specific kind of movement. And then you have these different variations of it, like you said. Like, by the time you figured, oh, a backflip might come in handy in here. You're already too late. You
of
know?
Course. Like,
yeah. And maybe only through multiple sessions of playing this game, you'll know what situations it's handy in. But do you really need it by that point if you already cleared the game without it in so many times? So it almost feels slightly redundant.
I did watch a speed run of it today, in which they were pretty much going backwards and backflipping over all of the enemies.
Ocarina
of
Time style,
You can use it.
You were saying the route for the speed run is predicated around how many backflips you can do in a room, like mapping out the amount of backflips.
I don't know
room.
That it's necessarily completely dependent on it, but it's definitely involved. They also
I'm just referring to what you said more than anything.
So a backflip at the top of your jump, is that higher than a regular forward jump, for example? So you can jump
slightly
backwards over enemies that you normally can't jump over?
Yeah, there's a couple of instances in the castle, especially at the last bit, where you can kind of sequence break the regular pathway and route in to be able to cut a fairly significant portion of the final stage, which at that point is quite punitive just after the clock tower. And it's pretty good. But the whole technology behind it, or the technique behind it rather, is basically the cancellation of the backflip, because you backflip and you're also committed to doing a fairly anime style slide right at the end. And the way that the speedrunners use it, of course, is to cancel that out and just chain backflips, which is I think he was saying, like, what, 0.2 like seconds faster than just your regular march, which is a significant time saving over time, but
over 20 minutes that it takes you to finish the game.
But then it's more of a speed running technique than anything else, right?
Yeah, like
not exactly like integrated into the, you know, the regular game mechanics all
quite
that.
There feels like no opportune moment in your cursory playthroughs to actually implement it, as cool as it would look. I'm not sure.
Maybe hop out of the way of a spear attack from some enemy or something.
Yes.
But then, like I said, typically when you see that, you know, when you're caught with your pants down for one of those spear attacks, it's all typically probably already too late to backflip out of the way. So the only use I can really see for it that's not speed run related is maybe just backflip over some irritating monster that you don't want to deal with.
I think
that's it. The one place sort of during, and I mean, this was during the speedrun, but I could see it actually being used just as a technique, is towards the end on the bridge with all the bats that are chasing you and the bridge is collapsing under you. If you're facing backwards, most of the bats are going to spawn in that direction. So if they do get close to you, you don't have to stop and turn around and then whip them to keep going. You can just kind of pause.
That's it.
So I could see that maybe being useful if you can pull it off. I don't think that I could. But,
there is a lot of button presses in that, of course, because if you hold the attack button, it does allow you to moonwalk backwards. So essentially, they're just playing the game walking backwards, which is a very alien thought in my head. But cool.
Very common in the world of speedrunning, surprisingly. And I would say the point you make about the lack of interruptibility or cancels, whatever you want to call it, is probably the thing that makes these games the most, it's probably the aspect of them that makes them hardest to come back to, or to, if you weren't familiar with them, to come to them as a new player now, because modern 2D games, there's a lot of, you know, very high quality stuff around, independently developed and whatever else, where your character tends to be hyper maneuverable and hyper interruptible, you know, extremely high levels of fidelity of control, which are baked into those games, whether it's Super Meat Boy or whatever else. And I think coming back to these games now, which were born out of 80s games and the rules not having been made for those things, it wasn't even that they couldn't have characters that were that much more maneuverable. It was just that the rules hadn't been written, and characters that committed to the arc of their jump and whatever else, and, you know, the lack of iframes and stuff like that. I mean, this one, unlike the SNES incarnation, does actually give you a little tiny window after you've been hit to recover. And I sort of would be interested, we haven't really had much feedback after we've put these shows out from any folks who have kind of attempted to play these, having listened to the podcast but never having played a Castlevania before. I mean, I know from my point of view that going back to play the Famicom, the NES ones in particular, I do find them incredibly challenging and quite frustrating.
Consider this, though. Dark Souls is a very popular thing in modern times.
Yeah.
Which also has very committed moves and animations and set in stone jump arcs and what have you.
Yeah.
Like,
I still feel like having played a lot of Demon's Souls for the show recently, I still feel like I've got more in the way of direct character control in those games.
But there's not really anything like, you know, canceling out of moves or anything. And also, if a game is designed around certain player limitations, it's not a huge issue whether it's a modern game or an older game, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, actually. Like, an observation that just came to my head. Visualizing the game in my head now, there is no leaps of faith. There's no really uncomfortable pixel perfect jumps. Like, no. All of the gaps seem to be predicated around the arc of your jump rather than something that needs you to do something slightly unfair. And I think that's a good marker for some considerate game design.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think so. I think, and that rings true even for the first Castlevania, which I was surprised when I played it, completed it finally, last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just how even, and I said that in the Castlevania 3 episode as well, like, at first, some of the stages seem ridiculously unfair and you take like hits left, right, and center. But as you repeat them and start learning them, you know, after a while you find, oh, I can actually do this without taking a single hit.
Like, absolutely.
I can do this without taking damage.
Yeah,
which
is
definitely the mark of a well-designed game. And a final thing that I would like to add is that even though this harks back way more to the NES trilogy, in terms of its dynamics and mechanics, it feels ever so slightly nippier, and you feel ever so slightly more agile and quicker off the mark and more responsive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I wasn't saying that this, you know, it's not even necessarily a slight. It's just a personal thing.
Yeah, sure.
I totally understand that the game is designed around your moveset, and it is very fairly designed, and everything is surmountable.
Yeah.
Especially once you start to learn where secrets are hidden and things like that. Yeah.
I get your point also. Like, if you played Hollow Knight, for example, and then go to this, it might feel, take some getting used to.
Yeah, I find personally, even as a fan of lots of old games and, you know, a strong desire to complete them and make podcasts about them, I still find that a lot of development that's happened on the character control side of things over the past 30 years has been stuff that I've enjoyed. And even if it's just a case of it feels more dynamic because you can get yourself out of a scrape that you've put yourself in by cancelling a jump or rolling or whatever. It just, for me, it's just that much more enjoyable. And I still like these games, and I'll probably give this one a positive reading at the end. And while I accept that it is obviously very carefully designed around the moveset that you have, I still find myself actually enjoying playing as Maria more because she's got that bit more maneuverability. Her attack is, you know, pops off quicker, and she's got that extra bit of maneuverability in the air and all that stuff. And to me, that's just a more fun experience to play. But obviously, the proper challenge, and the PS4 version does have trophies, is to beat the game with Richter rather than Maria.
Yeah, but to be snobbish about this, I do kind of think that Maria maybe trivializes the game a little bit, and it doesn't feel like Castlevania to me, which is an odd thing because I don't have a great history with the rest. But
I still think it's challenging.
Yeah,
that's why I still find it challenging
for sure.
Maria.
You still have to play the game with her. It's not like she makes everything trivial. It's not like an invisibility cheat or anything.
Like, yeah,
it's not a win button. Yeah.
It is a little. I do agree that Maria. I don't agree that it trivializes it. I do agree that it makes it easier. But there are some things about her. Like, if you get close enough to something that it hits you, she is very squishy.
Oh, yeah. She takes a ton more damage.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a little bit. They at least tried to put a little bit of balance in there. I don't think it's... Yeah. And, I mean, I think that's intentional, right? If you go through what you need to do to actually unlock her in the first place, then you get that reward of being able to do the rest of the game a little bit more easily if you want to. But
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's intentional.
Yeah. I was saying, I think Mikhail and I don't know about Leah and Rich, we both unlocked Maria without looking up any FAQs.
Yeah, exactly.
Any
completely FAQs. By accident.
Yeah, you did.
Because I was running down that hallway with the mad bull chasing me.
That's it.
And, you know, I think I failed once and then I thought like, oh, let's just leave those candles alone. I'll just keep moving forward. And then, yeah, I couldn't help myself and I just smashed one of the candles somewhere on the way and there was the key was in there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually did too. I lucked into I wandered off into that area. The PS4 version the first time.
So yeah, there's in total you have to complete 9 stages to clear the game. The prologue is the prologue, and that stays the same, whatever. But from stage 1 onwards, there are above and below stages, effectively, with the alternate stages for the next 4 marked number dash, and they've all got different names and totally different enemies, layouts, sprites. Yeah,
it's bosses.
Bosses. Yeah. Which is very cool. And as I say, that's what I've been doing, having just basically, you know, brute force my way through the game initially. This is actually how I've been having quite a lot of fun, is going back and playing, using the stage select to find the different paths and exits.
Yeah.
And that is new, I'm pretty sure, the stage select. I don't think any of the previous games do anything like that.
Because initially I thought like, oh, I'm going to have to start the game over from the beginning
and
select a different path. But then only after I completed the game, I actually discovered the stage select. And I thought, oh, this is really cool. I can just select certain stages and try to find the different paths.
Yeah, exactly. It's really cool. And it absolutely wasn't like a default option back in the early 90s for that to be the case. One thing I did notice, though, is that one place I saw it written up that it's a code that you put in to unlock the stage select, but it seems to be unlocked by default on all the versions I've got. So I'm not sure if they unlocked it in the re-release ROMs or that was an earlier version or something.
I would like to know that, because there's also the boss demonstration mode as well, right at the front, which gives you a good sort of clue about how to actually get through that. That seems like a very forgiving and accessibility kind of friendly for a 1993 game.
No, it was in there. That was in there originally. Yeah,
good on Konami. Something that I never thought I'd say in 2024.
You buy your I haven't actually worked out how you earn the money. Those just by playing, you seem to be racking up some kind of currency. It's not the money bags you're finding in the game, but you come back out and then any boss that you've already faced in the game, not the ones you haven't faced, there's the option to watch a play of somebody else doing it well, basically, or quite well. But yes, I don't actually know how it's dictating.
I think it's something
how
to
much
do with your score,
got.
But I'm not sure exactly what the conversion is.
Yeah, that would make sense. Because, yes, weirdly, this game does still have a scoring system, although it's pretty much redundant, other than you clock up extra lives. But, like, this is not a game you'd play for high score. Sometimes you end up with a big score because you've had a good long run without losing lives, and sometimes you don't. But you're jumping in and out of levels and resetting your score anyway. So, yeah, it feels a bit redundant. One thing that is new, or not new, but... hasn't always been the case. This game no longer has this version doesn't have time limits on the levels, which I appreciate because it allows for the experimentation and exploration.
And there's puzzles in the levels. There's a level where you have to encourage a frog to stand on a pedestal, which would be quite infuriating against the time limit to open up some stuff.
What? A frog on a pedestal?
Yeah, that might be in Castlevania Dracula X Chronicles, the remake, but that shares that kind of DNA. You know, it's essentially the same game.
Yeah, I did find some... obviously, I found some of the buttons. There's the one that the flea is squatting on and you kill him and then reveal the staircase. But I found there's a set of 3 buttons on one of the lower levels that I didn't work out what I was exactly supposed to do with, but probably has something to do with... one of the alternate paths. Yeah, and some of the puzzles of actually working out the escape route for the next stage are quite interesting. There's some other little secrets in there as well that just like squatting in certain places reveals secret items and stuff like that, which again I think has been done before, and it feels a bit arbitrary in the sense that they're a bit sort of not random where they happen, but there's no clue or indication, so it's just a case of trying stuff out. But
well, that is straight out of Castlevania 2, right? Because there's the
bit where you have to
kneel facing a wall for 30 seconds to get a friggin' tornado to carry you away.
That's right. Yeah. And I think we said that was ridiculous.
I hope so. Can't remember, but I'm pretty sure.
In this one, it's all slightly less ridiculous and mainly optional as well. But yeah, there's fun stuff like the bomb in the wall. I guess you all found that one where you smash into it and then blow up, and it reveals the whole alternate path and yeah, all that good stuff. Yes, plenty to see and do. You've got like a save file percentage, which again feels kind of ahead of its time in some ways. But all this stuff does, as our previous correspondent said, sort of, even though it isn't actual Metroid type stuff, it feels like it's where, with 3 and this one, Castlevania was just starting to look at the idea of making it a bit more of a, not freeform experience, but exploratory experience rather than in pure linear. Sub-weapons are back, and in this case, there's a new feature, which is item crash, where each of your specials, if you've got enough hearts, has an alternate attack, some of which, I dare say, are way more useful than others.
Yeah.
Any expansion on sub-weapon use or items or item crash?
It's interesting that they did a full different set of sub-weapons for Maria as well. And she also has item crashes, and they are also occasionally devastating, especially the dragon. Takes a ton of hearts to do it, but if you can get there, it's pretty.
I started
impressive.
Using them less and less throughout the game. The item crashes.
Yeah, I don't use them.
I felt in most cases like, oh, it's actually better to just hold on to more sub weapons. You know,
I would say that the one that I found to be probably the most. Useful was Richter's holy water item crash, which basically just gives you a rain of holy water that can hit things multiple times.
Yeah. Lovely.
So that's pretty nice.
I have a sickness in my brain where I look at the item crashes as I look at elixirs in JRPGs, which is I love having them, and yet I'm very seldom using them because I need to save it for a desperate moment that never really comes, unfortunately. But some of them are more useful than others. In particular, like Leah says, the holy water, the knife one. I think if you pick up a knife in this game, you're probably not playing the game correctly, personally. The axe is circumstantially very useful in level 1, but then never really returns. But there's certain weapons in the game that simply have a basic attack which is better than the item crash, like the holy Bible. That essentially just rips the game to pieces and makes it exceedingly easy for Richter just to deal an exceptional level of damage without really having to do a great deal. It seems to me the best way of visualizing them for me was when looking at the way that speedrunners kind of approach the game, which is they've got it down to whip 3 times, move to this location, item crash, and mathematically work out the most elegant way to get through the boss as possible.
Yeah. I'm always struck by that stuff when I watch speedrunners, because obviously that is the point that you get to with a game where if you play it enough, you know it to that finer point, that level of granular detail. And there are probably games that I like enough to kind of play to that level, but it's weird. It's like a whole other thing. It's like seeing the Matrix, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it also often makes you realize just how very carefully designed these games like this were, how good how superb a studio Konami was at this point in terms of making everything absolutely, you know, kind of spot on, but also they were still beholden to that 8-bit game design, which was, yeah, kind of make things very, very specific and quite tricky and a bit oblique. But yeah, this does feel like a little movement in the direction of kind of what we've gotten more used to.
For sure. But can you imagine seeing this for the first time in 1983, having gone through 7, 8, 9 years of Castlevanias at that point? It's just a real visual feast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially if you come off, like, if you'd only played, say, the Game Boy one or the NES one.
Precisely. And a selling point, no doubt, as well.
Yeah. I found a giant heart earlier. I don't know if there's only one in the entire game. You know how there's one boss where before the boss you get like a massive wall meat or cake?
Yes, yeah. Dullahan, I think that is. Yeah. The Headless Horseman.
Refills your entire health bar. There's also at least one completely giant heart of the same size, which gives you like maybe 80 or 90 hearts or something. I can't remember. So, or maybe it's 99 maximum. I don't know. But if you get that and then don't die, you've obviously got a lot of uses of even the more deadly item crashes. I enjoy Maria's cute item crashes, such as the cat, which is, I guess, like a white tiger, but it's a little cat.
And the egg, which baffles me. Yeah.
I mean, no idea what's going on with that.
It essentially hatches and a flock of doves come out, and then the item crashes, basically more doves. It's pretty good. It's good against death.
The red
bird
is
in a good direction.
Those red birds are great against death. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Devastating. And they also made me realize, all this stuff makes me realize where so many of the weapons in Vampire Survivors came from. There's absolutely tons of bird and pigeon and stuff related enemies
of course,
in that game.
Yeah. I have to ask, did anybody understand how to use the tortoise shell? Because to this point, I still haven't got a clue.
Yeah, if you hold it down, then it just takes a hit for you. Sometimes multiple hits.
Okay, fair enough.
I used it for one of the bosses. I can't remember which one. It might have been the Headless Horseman, actually.
Yeah. I avoided it like the plague because I always feel like the best offense or the best defense is the best offense in these games, at least.
No, typically I agree with you, but if there's where I found it to be for whichever boss it was that I used it for, the reason that I had picked it up was because there was some attack that they were doing that I was having a really hard time
avoiding.
So my rationale was, well, I don't really need the thing for the attack, so I can just take this and, you know, use that
exactly
to get through that one attack.
And Maria doesn't typically have a trouble hitting bosses anyway.
No, she doesn't.
No, that's exactly it. The some boss attacks don't even smash the shell, so you can like withstand an entire barrage of, I don't know, fireballs or something.
Right.
If the boss like lances you in the face or something, then you will have your shell shattered, but you won't take any damage.
There's a couple where they run into something or smash something and stuff falls from the ceiling, and you can use it for that. I don't think that breaks the shell.
There's a werewolf boss has an attack that simply just bursts through it and deals damage anyway. So that's perhaps why I wasn't seeing that correctly. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, not universally useful, but in certain situations, I think it can be.
That's most of them, isn't it? Situational. Mm-hmm. Bosses wise, then any hated ones, any favorites, any interesting strats? Or
I think that this is one of the easier Draculas, but one of the harder run-ups to Dracula.
Yeah,
because of the boss rush.
I found Final Dracula really easy because I've done it dozens and dozens of times playing the opening of Symphony of the Night, which was quite nice. On the flip side, the boss rush in Stage 6, which is a rerun of most of the bosses from the original Castlevania, is quite challenging.
Really? Oh, I like that. I think I don't know. I just didn't find it particularly very difficult. I think the only problem is the jumping on the mummy's stones that fly out, because you can get yourself in severe trouble fairly quickly.
Yes. I guess it's for me, it's just like getting anxious because it's a relatively long sequence.
Quite.
And starting to get flustered in a way that in a way that is unhelpful.
Yeah.
But you do get at least you get something of a snack refill after the mummy.
I too need a snack after fighting a few enemies.
Exactly. Before fighting the creature.
Yes.
And Shaft. Mm.
Yeah, I'm still disappointed that the Isaac Hayes theme Shaft doesn't play when you fight him.
They could have done it on this game as well. They could have had exactly. Some actual guitar. Yeah.
The Shaft fight, it might be Shaft's Mirage where he's casting bats down. I found that really difficult. And I know that there is an infinite kind of loop stun that you can put Shaft in, but I couldn't make it happen in my game. I was forever getting sort of inundated by the bats. When you watch,
I know what you're talking about. It looks so easy when they do it, and yeah. I can't pull it off either.
Just move left, punch it, move right, whip it, and you know, it just locks in an infinite loop. But it must be incredibly specifically timed. It took me quite a while to get there, and I think I mentioned it seemed unlikely that I would ever get past level 7, but yeah, it was fine. And Dracula, still quite easy. Actually, like, kind of enjoy going back and just fighting Dracula as a sort of like power fantasy of going there and kicking his butt for a while and feeling really good. It's the first instance of feeling like I had some kind of command over the game, which made us feel a lot better about myself.
Yeah, it's surprisingly looking at also at the equivalent in the SNES version, which looks utterly miserable, utterly just. It's got loads of bottomless pits in the middle of the screen, and it's all at different heights.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
Oh, my God.
I'll be using a save state capable version for that, I do believe.
Yeah. I think I'll just avoid the game.
A really bizarre difficulty spike, because the rest of the game is significantly easier, in my opinion. But the last boss, wow, it's just a huge difficulty spike because...
I'd heard it was harder all the way through, but... Due to lack of iframes.
Well, I'll fight whoever it was that gave you that advice then, Leon. And we'll see who wins.
It was a YouTube video. So 17 bosses, I think, in the game, which is a lot for a 9-stage game. But of course, it's actually a lot more than that. Nothing more needs be said. Water Dragon. That one gave me a little problem at first.
It's because it moves in almost a three-dimensional manner, so it's very difficult to sort of detect where the hitbox is going to be. I mean, I must admit, it's been a while since I've taken that particular route through the game. That was the first time I played through it, that was the route that I went through, and I've elected not to do it since. But it again, it's one of those things as well. I think the execution of it is really interesting to look at, the actual application of the boss less so.
It's very Konami-esque, reminds me of a lot of their games from that era where they were playing around with sort of 2.5D concepts.
I did have the thought of Sparkster Rocket Knight thinking about that.
Precisely, yes. Sparkster Collection is coming. I'm happy
is
about
it?
That. Yeah.
Is it though?
For real. It's Konami, who knows? And there's a few other not bosses, and not even I don't know if they count as sub bosses, but like screen stoppers where like a room full of weapons or a painting or a skull with three eyeballs,
the behemoth that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all good fun stuff, stomping about. Note that the Shaft at the end of the stage 6 boss rush in the 2.5D remake on PSP and the PS4 version on Requiem has actually had its HP halved compared to the original one.
I feel like such a badass now.
Yeah. So yeah, that will be the version on Wii Virtual Console, and the PC Engine Mini will have the original health. But the PS4 version, they nerfed him slightly, so thank you for that.
And that's the only detectable difference in difficulty.
Barely anything, yeah. I've not found any evidence of any other differences, really.
Shaft is where they drew the line.
Yeah. The title screen is different, because they westernized it. Yeah. So, multiple endings. In order to get the better ending for Richter, the player has to save all four maidens, even if you don't get 100% completion of the game. So I've been monitoring my completion stats Ironically, I've now got a higher completion stat on the uncompleted game because I've done more of the levels, if you see what I mean. So I think I've got 62% on the completed game, and I'm now up to 66% on the game that I'm less far through. But again, it's another, it actually reminds me a bit of the, you know, the famous fun of hunting down all the percentages, the 200.6% on Symphony of the Night.
It sure is.
Slightly different, but similar sort of level of fun. So all four maidens, you've done this, Rich, right?
Yes. Yes.
I have not. So I've seen some other locked doors and cages. Are they all behind locked doors? Is that how it works?
Not quite. So with each one of the maidens, they'll give you a specific ability. So one of them allows you to break down some of the red skeletons. There's a few walls. And one of them is behind a one-directional like wall itself to go through. So it's not all through keys. Two of the four, I think either two or three of the four of them are behind keys, but one of them is just behind a very kind of discreet wall that you need to break through. It didn't take terribly long. I think I did it on the Dracula X Chronicles version of the game.
Okay.
It was fine. I'm not really sure what else to say about it, to be honest.
Are they all on the same... like path? Can you get them all in one?
Yes, you can do it in one motion. That cool. is true.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I know Maria's before it splits, I believe, right?
Like, you can do it all as Maria, certainly in Dracula X Chronicles as well, which makes it fairly pleasant to go through. I think nice. Actually,
what happens if you try to unlock Maria as Maria?
No.
She's just not there. I don't think
that is. Yeah, there's just a load of candles with some money in there.
So one of the maidens is Richter's fiancée, right? Annette.
That's true. The final. I think in the original version of... the original version. In Rondo of Blood, it's the only one that has a cutscene. And she's... it's really strange. She's delighted to see him. And he basically brushes her off and tells her to go home. Because he's got
go back to the village.
Settle, which is quite funny. But
one thing I only learned about... just scanning through a good old-fashioned GameFAQs HTML walkthrough yesterday was that Maria has like a special move that you can do even when you don't have any hearts or sub-weapon.
Yep.
Her alter ego attack, which is like a fireball motion type.
Yeah, like Hadouken. A conventional Street Fighter style.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, indeed.
And it's quite powerful.
Which... again, that kind of continuity between Symphony of the Night and and Rondo of Blood as well. It is, yeah. There's it's like a, I think it does essentially two attacks as opposed to just one or something similar to that. I've only ever seen it used. I've never managed to execute it. I have incredibly poor dexterity in my left hand. I think we had a chat about this the other evening.
I like the way you're saying that while also having said, I found this game quite easy and I've done everything in it and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
You're a walking contradiction.
Indeed.
Hmm.
Mystery wrapped in an enigma, etc.
Yeah. Lamar Fiddy from our Patreon says, as a youngster, delving into the dark and treacherous world of Castlevania Rondo of Blood on the PC Engine or TurboGrafx-16 some 20 years ago, I was immediately struck by its atmospheric presentation and challenging gameplay. The game's gothic aesthetic and haunting soundtrack set the stage for a harrowing journey through Dracula's castle, where every corner was teeming with danger and every enemy posed a formidable threat. While the difficulty curve was steep, requiring precise timing and strategic planning, I found myself drawn to the challenge, determined to conquer each stage and emerge victorious against the forces of darkness. Despite facing numerous setbacks and moments of frustration, I persisted through Castlevania Rondo of Blood, driven by a combination of curiosity and sheer determination. Each defeat only fueled my resolve to improve my skills and overcome the formidable obstacles that stood in my path. From navigating treacherous platforming sections to facing off against relentless bosses, every victory felt hard-earned and immensely satisfying. The game's tight controls and responsive gameplay mechanics ensured that success ultimately came down to skill and perseverance, rewarding those willing to put in the effort to master its intricacies. Looking back on my experience with Rondo of Blood, I'm struck by the lasting impression it's left on me both as a gamer and a fan of the series. Despite its unforgiving difficulty and steep learning curve, the game remains a shining example of classic 2D action platforming at its finest. Its atmospheric presentation, challenging gameplay, and sense of accomplishment in overcoming adversity continue to resonate with players to this day, cementing its status as a beloved entry in the iconic Castlevania franchise. See? Lamar Fiddy says it's a tough game, Rich. How long to beat wise, for those curious, how long to beat has it at 3.5 hours for the main story or 6 hours for main plus sides? Completionist 7 hours, but I guess it'll depend on how difficult you find it. but it does sound like, once you're kind of familiar with things, you can kind of whip through it, if you'll pardon the pun, and even rescue the maidens on the way. The speed run situation, I think the run, well, the one I posted on the show notes, if that's the one you folks watched as well from GDQ from a few years back, was Agent Wyvern, who is a British speedrunner who is the current world record holder. The run from GDQ, I think, was 22 minutes or something like that. But Agent Wyvern's world record time is 20 minutes and 46 seconds. So that is a lot of backdashing.
Yeah. I did fish it out and take a look at this, and it's really impressive. And one of the things that's clear, having read it is a game where RNG is rife and really will dictate the run that you're about to have.
Yes.
And finding the perfect RNG seems to be the pursuit that really drove him towards getting there. And the speed run that essentially captured the world record was like weirdly elegant. It just kind of, flew through everything with minimal kind of resistance. So dig it out at 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You can do it while eating your cornflakes in the morning. It's very pleasant.
Well, actually, I think we should expand on that slightly, because I did really want to mention this, because so often watching a speedrun, while it is for most of us, like we'll watch a speedrun of a particular game, even if it's a game we like, and go, yeah, I ain't never doing that. I don't know how you could even begin to do that. There's always something to learn from it. And in this case, it was, There was part of me thinking, one of the things that I don't like about these games, this series of games and this type of design, is that it's very it's not scripted, but it's like the same set of actions over and over again. But this game actually does have a certain amount of RNG in terms of where enemies appear and things like that. Well, yeah, Rich, perhaps you can expand, having watched this run, like what are the elements where the RNG, he says, come into play? It's stuff like which attacks bosses do first and
indeed,
stuff like that?
Like essentially what pattern of techniques the boss is going to choose, the appearance of certain enemies on the screen.
That's
A classic example would be the bridge, the falling bridge. You can really get essentially shafted by the amount of bats that are coming your way. You can backflip as fast as you like, but those bats will catch up to you. And what's kind of interesting is the way in which they've broken it down into certain circumstances essentially equate to certain elements of time or periods of time that are going to stagger it by. So they'll say, like, this boss pattern will save you 6 seconds. And what this Agent Wyvern had clearly done is kind of found a way to work out the right, like, RNG, the most optimal patterns of behavior from bosses and the enemies that are going to give him the kind of neatest run through. So it's weird, because the best run often is perhaps not the best one to understand the level, because you're seeing less of it, or you're seeing a pattern of behavior that that kind of makes it a little bit easier for you to do. But nonetheless, it's just a sort of beautiful consolidation of randomness and technique coming together in one motion.
Yeah, just play it a few tens of thousands of times and eventually you'll get the perfect run.
Yeah, that's right.
It was interesting to note that the top eight are all playing it the Wii Virtual Console version, which makes sense. There's some emulated TurboGrafx versions. There's absolutely no one breaking records on the PS4 version. I don't know if that's just because it's never caught on, or whether there are reasons why you're unlikely to get world records on it.
I bet it's the latter, because speedrunners are nuts with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like being able to just optimize the smallest things that people might not notice if they were playing it just kind of on a casual basis.
I wonder
possibly
what it is.
Also language and characters.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, there's a certain amount of skipping and things like that. The one thing I did want to mention about the Requiem version, and it's absolutely not something that should put people off buying that double pack, because it's a great thing to have. It's the fact that it's so bare bones a package, they did not even include a vibration off option in the menu. So they've made it so that this game is really rumbly. I've kind of got used to it now, but for a while I was actually turning off controller DualSense rumble or DualShock in the console settings.
Right.
Very strange oversight, but yeah, it was clearly a fairly cheap and cheerful package. They did a bit better with the following year's Castlevania Anniversary Collection.
And there's also some oddities in the PS4 Requiem version where it'll all push out of your controller sound effects, which was interesting because I hope nobody from my job's listening, but I was playing this while in a quite a tedious meeting the other day, and Richter Belmont's massive cacophonous death sound came out while I was in the middle of a call, which was quite
excellent. Thing. I already have those turned.
So that is where it went.
I have those switched off.
I was wondering
off.
Why it didn't come out of my throat.
If you already have your control speakers switched off, then that's not an issue. But yeah.
Lesson learned.
Tolkien, again from a forum, says, after Super Castlevania 4, I was truly hoping for a new one to come out for Super Nintendo. One day, while browsing through a foreign magazine about video games in Japan, I saw some screenshots of Rondo of Blood, and it blew my mind. It looked great, but it was coming out for a console called PC Engine that I'd never heard of. And yet the graphics were fantastic, and the game wasn't a cartridge. It was a CD. Then, like a year and a half after that, the miracle. Konami was going to release a port of Rondo for SNES, SNES, oddly titled Vampire's Kiss. But that was kind of the same game, right? Right? We all thought that. Castlevania 4 was just a marvel. Vampire's Kiss is a disgusting joke. Perhaps a bit harsh. So, very nicely, M2 did include this as a bonus extra on the Castlevania Advance Collection. So, as well as the GBA trilogy, they just whacked this on there. So, it's nice because it means you can kind of own the complete set on modern systems. I've only played it a tad. You will immediately recognize large elements of it from Rondo of Blood. According to Wikipedia, while the plot is similar to Rondo of Blood and it uses many of that game's graphics, it features all new levels and altered gameplay elements instead of being a straight port due to the limitations of the cartridge format and PC Engine exclusivity obligations. The game was re-released as part of the Castlevania Advance Collection, September 23rd, 21, for Switch, PS4, Xbox One, and Windows. And it's still available, and it's often cheap, as we always say. But, as I say, I read elsewhere that the reason this game isn't perhaps as successful, well-liked as it should have been, was to do with its interrupted development due to literal, you know, environmental issues, acts of God, whatever you want to call it. You've played it a bit more than I have, by the sounds of it, Rich.
Yeah, it's weird. I've osmosed my information about Dracula X over a while because I'll play it and forget that I've played it, and then come back and go, "Oh yeah, I remember this boss." My abiding memory of it is, it's fine. It feels like a pretty perfunctory Castlevania game. I mean, there's not a great deal of insight that I can bring to this conversation beyond, you know, you do a level, you do a boss, you move on to the next one. It feels like a good showcase for like late SNES kind of development, because there's really interesting music and visually it's quite an attractive game as well, but I don't think it really brings anything that Rondo of Blood kind of brought, and I don't think it furthers the kind of the paradigm in a way that potentially Soten did somewhere in the next couple of years beyond that. So
yeah.
Tepid response from me there.
Mikhail, you know much about this one?
No, I never had much of an urge to play it after watching some videos and seeing that it just looks like a pale imitation of Rondo of Blood, really, to me. Like, also strangely empty in the level designs, you know, like, it looks a bit barren overall.
Mm, it sounds
first
like
stage, the fire hazy effect, yes. The first stage looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it's quite cool that they got to have fun with some of the effects that obviously lent themselves more to Super Nintendo's tricks than they did to PC Engine's. But yeah.
If you come from Super Castlevania 4 and wouldn't know anything about Rondo of Blood, which was definitely not unthinkable,
yeah,
then going to Vampire's Kiss, yeah, you could only imagine the disappointment, right?
Yeah. So it was released for Super Famicom and Super Nintendo in 95 in Japan in the summer, and then in the autumn or the fall in North America, and then February 96 in the EU, which was a very late release for the Super Nintendo. I do vaguely recall seeing it in shops, but I was obviously I still had my Super Nintendo and loved it, but I was probably less likely to rush out and buy £40 SNES cartridges at that point. I'm probably spending most of my money on PlayStation 1 games by then. It also arrived in Australia in the summer of 96. It did get a Wii U VC re-release virtual console in Japan and North America, but not in Europe. That was in 2014. And it even got a 3DS virtual console re-release in North America in 2016. But of course, the Wii U and 3DS stores are now shut. So is that information useful? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think I realized that it was actually on the Castlevania Advance Collection for the consoles, and that particular collection does have save states, which this does not. So I don't know. Maybe I'll just go and poke around in it a little bit just to say that I did.
And the Dracula X Chronicles, which we've already alluded to as well, the 2.5 remake of Rondo of Blood for the PSP includes the original PC Engine game with both Japanese and English voices and a port of its sequel, Symphony of the Night, available as an unlockable secret embedded within the base game. Gameplay in Dracula X Chronicles remains largely unchanged from Rondo of Blood. However, a boss rush mode was added, and completing it three times unlocks the minigame Peek, or possibly Peke, I'm not sure, which is also playable on the PC Engine Mini. 2.5D graphics. I watched some play of this. I don't own the UMD. It wasn't released digitally, I don't think. Obviously, you can play it on a Vita, in theory, if you had a digital copy or whatever. There was an interesting discussion under a video of this of a war between some people who like sprite graphics versus polygon graphics. It was like the one person going, imagine if they remade this for modern consoles, and then people saying, what are you on about? Why would they do this one, not the one with the beautiful sprite art? And it kind of escalated from there into a people who like sprite art are weirdos, or people who like 2.5D polygons are weirdos, and you know how these things go down.
Yeah, in the end, we're all weirdos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
Not me. I'm very normal.
Very. I think it would be really cool if obviously it's now been 6 years since the Castlevania Anniversary Collection, but if Konami were to do another collection of games, I think it would be great if they could include this for completion's sake, make it playable on modern systems, or even if it was one of the games that Sony incorporated on their classics catalog for PlayStation Plus. That would be something.
I added to the list of things that we wish Konami would do, I'm sure.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you make a good point. Obviously, you can play this on emulation, or by hook or by crook, whatever else. Probably worthwhile.
Yeah, I am very earnestly and with good intentions emulated this game to play through today, and I did the Four Maidens run through of it because in the Dracula X Chronicles version, doing so gives you a third stage to the Dracula end boss fight, which is quite interesting really, because you get transported into some kind of dark realm, and then Dracula throws a ton of really interesting magic at you. Mixed feelings about it. It is a incredibly ugly game, in my opinion. not because the kind of art design is inconsistent or, you know, denigrates some of the work that's done at the sort of 1993 Rondo of Blood equivalent. It's a readability thing. That 2.5D is not easy to sort of like parse to me, certainly.
Right.
So playing it, I found it very difficult to be able to understand like depth with certain characters. And also there's, which something that kind of was in vogue during the time, like a lot of characters jumping from the background into the foreground and such like that. So you've really got to kind of have your wits about you. It's a very faithful adaptation of Rondo of Blood, I would say, with one or two kind of minor tweaks and a certain additional sort of enhancements to certainly like the last level in particular, which is where I noticed that they completely overhauled the post-clock tower level and the pre-shaft fight. Yeah, I'm not unpleased to have played it, but I can't recommend it over Rondo of Blood, certainly in 2024, where Rondo is by far the more easily available of the two.
Yeah, ironic. So this was, PSP 2007-2008. Looks like a PSP game from that era. Although in an interesting aspect, I would say, is that the character designs got redone by Symphony of the Night artist Ayami Kojima. So you've got perhaps more artful, if not faithful to the original sort of in-game character design.
That'll be why they took Maria's Lolita dress and Sailor Jupiter haircut away from her as well and gave her something a little bit more consistent. Yeah, she's way less obnoxious in this version, which you know, you may enjoy or not.
Yeah. anything on this one, McHugh, Leah?
I haven't played it, unfortunately. So, aside from potentially a little bit when it came out, I would have been at GameStop around that time. So, I definitely did that, but I'm about 99% sure I did not finish it. So, it will have been almost 20 years since I touched
Good
that.
Good God,
not quite.
I haven't played it. Hashtag CRTWR.
Haven't played.
The only other thing I would say just before we move off of this is the wider aspect ratio of the PSP screen does change things slightly, so enemies will kind of activate more quickly, and some of the things that you may rely upon in Rondo of Blood, like specifically in the shaft fight, it makes it you can't do the kind of juggling thing because it becomes a bit of a problem. So it's a bit of a kind of like at that molecular level, like a slightly different experience.
Yeah. Good observation. But yes, someone make it available. Alex Dola from our Patreon says, having beaten a large portion of the earlier Castlevania games within the last couple of years, I rather naively thought I could just breeze through this one in a matter of hours. Nope. Let me tell you though, those first four stages look very nice on the PSP remake. The sound and music are pretty stellar too. I miss having a multi-directional whip. And without any kind of dodge or block move, the combat is wholly dependent on your movement and positioning as a player. I thought the bosses I did fight were nicely designed, and it's clear that this is a quality entry into the long-running series. Mr. Ixolite says, my only complaint about the original Rondo of Blood is that Dracula's very cool-looking second form is a bit of a pushover. This would be somewhat remedied in the PSP port by the addition of a third and harder form. Said game's murkier polygon-based art didn't really appeal to me, but I guess you can't have it all. Echoing very much what Rich just said. Cursory mention of Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. Mr. Ixolite says, 5.5 years ago, I found myself in a maternity ward watching the newest Smash Ultimate reveal during a rare moment's rest. When I saw that Simon Belmont was to be added to Super Smash Bros., my heart soared. But the reveal that Richter would join him made me squeal with glee, and I've proceeded to use him to smack many a Fire Emblem character off the stage with a well-timed whip. I did not expect that when booting up that weird emulator all those years earlier. Smash?
I do have the amiibo of Richter and Simon.
Oh,
they,
cool.
They lived on my desk at work until 2020 when all of my at-work desk stuff came home with me and has not been back. So,
Oh, that's cute. Amiibos. They just published a graphic with every Amiibo from Smash in one picture. Yeah. Just the other day, which was pretty cool. Don't know how much Richter would set you back now, but
no idea. Anyway. I got them when they were new. I don't know if they're difficult to find now or not.
I know that Simon was still pretty affordable over time. Yeah, been back in the back of my mind to get one of those at least.
Smash just had an update as we record this. It's February 2024. The game came out five years ago, something like that. Just had a patch and some new stickers added.
Interesting. I mean, you'd think that at this point they'd give Masahiro Sakurai a break, but you know, here he is still doing the do.
Maybe he's not personally hands-on. I don't know.
Mario Kart 8 came out like 10 years ago, and they're still doing stuff with that. So Nintendo hangs on when things do work.
That's true.
Yeah.
And finally, we should mention, we did mention it, but once again, Castlevania Nocturne. So this is the latest version of the Netflix animation, which broadly very well received. Our Jay was not a fan, but I still haven't watched it, which I think is a massive oversight on my part.
Yeah, watch it. It's very entertaining.
Yeah. Have you watched any of the new ones? So Richter's in the new one, right? That's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, the Richter's in there, and Maria is in there,
right?
And Annette, and the rest I won't spoil because there are some surprises along the way.
So it's set in 1792 during the French Revolution.
Yes,
is Dracula in it?
Not really.
Oh,
Leon Belmont.
Yeah.
The one from the lady from the Game Boy game that has been like excised from canon. I can't remember what her name is.
Sonia Belmont.
Thank you.
No, she the one with the homing magic that makes the game a lot easier. I forgot.
No.
If you've got a Netflix account, that exists. Maybe there are other ways to watch it. I wouldn't know. Andrew Elmore from our forum says, after many years of careful deliberation, Castlevania Rondo of Blood is my favorite 2D action game, period. I determined that to be the case for myself at some point at least a decade ago, and it's held through countless attempts at personal re-evaluation since. Leon described the concept of an epic shelf of all-time personal best of the best of the best games at the top of the top tier. Rondo of Blood is one of those games for me without question, hesitation, or even a moment's consideration. That internal conflict has already been held and reheld with Rondo yet to be defeated. Aside, I did not come up with the concept of the epic shelf. Credit for that goes to Darren Garget.
Yeah, the concept of the epic shelf.
Yes.
I love just that first line as well. I picture Andrew just, you know, carefully deliberating for years and years on end.
With a pair of spectacles on his nose,
sitting
of string.
Sitting in a lonely castle tower room, you know? Yeah.
We also
good stuff.
Have some words, just three of them at a time, reviewing Rondo of Blood.
Tom Hewlett says, original Castlevania anime.
Bearfish Pie says, PSP remake, generous.
Kess86 says, Maria throws doves.
Negro Kage says, Prelude to Symphony.
And Robin Hoodie says, hype is justified.
Cool. So there we have it. Rondo of Blood. Just remains for us to summarize now our feelings. Do we recommend this one? I'll go first. Again, I keep saying this, not because I'm particularly negative on the game, just because feel like the others will probably have something more interesting to say. Another Castlevania that was on the backlog, the pile of shame, whatever you want to call it, for many years. And I do still feel I have unfinished business with it. I still haven't done the Four Maidens run, haven't got all the trophies on the PS4 version. But I am having a good time going back through, picking through the levels, trying to solve the puzzles without resorting to guides and walkthroughs, which is enjoyable. This is essentially marks the end of like the first era of Castlevania. If you take Super Castlevania as a sort of aside, a reimagining of the first game, which is what it was, with slightly different controls and some different mechanical ideas. And I really like that game. That's one of my favorites of the series, for the reasons I probably went into on that podcast. But this one does so much of the stuff that was cool for me about the NES games, the Famicom games, that original trilogy, which I do think are really cool, but for me are probably a bit too tough, a bit too uncompromising to return to at this point in terms of character control and enemy placement and the amount it demands of you and the lack of kind of ability to express yourself in terms of gameplay or extricate yourself from difficult situations. I realized I sort of wrapped two into one and three there, which is also, if I think back to us covering that game, that's probably not fair either. But this to me feels like the culmination of, yeah, perhaps the Castlevania 1 and 3 sort of lineage, even though there were, you know, plenty of others in between times. We've still got the Mega Drive game to go, which will be interesting. It looks quite different off the bat. This one does absolutely come with a recommendation for the series. And in fact, if you were only going to play one of the pre-Metroid influenced Castlevanias, this might be it. It's probably got the most variety, the most to do, with some really cool CD music, and some very nice early 90s sprite art, pixel work, and all that sort of good stuff. So, yeah, I think there'll still be some frustration for some players coming back to it. I've certainly had some, but if you persist, you can be like Rich and find it all a breeze. But yeah, PS4 version, plays on a PS5, perfectly good way to play it. And really, you can't buy the Wii U Virtual Console version anymore. The PC Engine Mini is now overpriced, I think. So yeah, if you haven't got that, then, well, there's always emulation, of course. But yeah, check it out, especially if you have liked a Castlevania but haven't played that one. It's the missing one that you should play. Leah.
I also recommend this game, and I think that the PlayStation, PS4 or PS5 version is the way to go if you have access to one of those consoles. I really like the music. I think that it's one of the highlights of the game is the music, but it also looks really nice, and I think that it controls pretty well. I think what really tips it for me into kind of an unqualified recommend is that if you are having difficulty with the game, this is kind of one of the first ones where there's something you can do about that to maybe take the edge off that difficulty a little bit in getting Maria unlocked and available. And, you know, that is, especially if you're just starting out or if you just don't want to bang your head against the wall, if you get Maria in there, then you are likely to have an easier time while still retaining some of that challenge. So yeah, I think that this is a really good entry in the series. I'm gonna decline to say whether I think it's my favorite pre-Symphony Castlevania, because I'm not sure, but it's up there for sure. I think that it's got a lot of factors in it that make it kind of an interesting one to keep coming back to. So yeah, recommendation from me.
Cool. Mikhail?
Yeah, having sat down to finally play through this, I could say a classic. It kind of cements to me once again, you know, why I strongly prefer the linear action platforming variation of Castlevania over the Metroidvania ones. I have yet to really, you know, invest time in those, but I've dabbled with them. And whereas those games kind of like the satisfaction is more in conquering the map and upgrading your character, I think they just don't have the strong moment-to-moment gameplay that the linear Castlevanias have, where, you know, every sort of level, every bit of every level feels very carefully designed and handcrafted as a little, yeah, action platforming puzzle to sort of make your way through and yeah, bit by bit master. And like Leon has already said before, this sort of feels like a lusher, richer realization of the 8-bit Castlevanias in so many ways. So I could totally get behind that if you, but you totally should play them all, but if you would only play one in that style, then Rondo of Blood is definitely the one, despite my sort of early hiccups with it, with, you know, just being a bit weirded out by its high-quality CD music in conjunction with the visuals, being kind of disappointed in the, yeah, the straight-up NES-style whip controls. But yeah, I mean, it all fits within the game and how it is designed. And then you have the sort of more organic way of, you know, choosing different routes through the game rather than, you know, on a map select screen, just actually find the different routes throughout the stages. It's a wholly magical package. And yeah, I can't wait actually to dive back into it and, you know, get that 100% completion of my file. And I might even, if I get to a point where money is less of a consideration, just go out and try to get my hands on an original copy. At this point, it just starts to feel like one of those things that is still missing from my video game collection. Yeah, and in the end, you get to fight Shaft in it as well. You're damn right.
Don't forget to post pics when you... when you get your factory sealed copy of Rondo of Blood for
factory sealed for sure,
50,000 yeah. Krugerrands or whatever you. No, I know. I've been to. I'm being silly. Let's conclude with Rich.
Yeah, I like this game. I like it a lot. Actually, it's been nice to play. I am not a person who is burdened with any prior knowledge of much of the NES versions of Castlevania, and I played Super Castlevania 4, but really, that's about it in pre-1994 Castlevania games. What I did play, however, is a lot of Master of Darkness, the Sega Master System ripoff, maybe is probably the right word. So I do have some experience with it. And for that reason, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to say this, but for me, this is the best expression of that kind of classic NES Castlevania formula. And I have played Bloodlines and Castlevania Dracula X, so I can comfortably admit that for me, I'd quite happily die on that particular hill. The game's lush, the graphics are beautiful, the kind of moment-to-moment gameplay is captivating, and the music's resplendent. There's just something in there that just makes it feel like a very polished and very appealing package. But I have to say, the thing that appeals to me most about this particular game is that it's something that I don't experience very often these days. And I last probably got this when I was playing through Metroid in preparation for the Metroid show for Kane and Rince. I could absolutely feel myself slipping into, ooh, this is a hard game, but it's becoming more and more easy and recognizable and almost like predictable, and the patterns are kind of blending, and because of that I feel like I'm in a flow state and a peaceful frame of mind, and this is actually quite a therapeutic game to play. Nice. Where once it was very stressful. And since completing it for the first time the other day, I've gone back and done the final two missions maybe about 10 to 20 times just for fun. Wow. More than anything, to see if I can kind of get myself into a good flow state and sort of become quite natural at this game. And there's very few games in 2024 where you've got this glut of games and almost like inundated with opportunities in the landscape that we are, that I can sort of see myself going back to, and Castlevania Rondo of Blood's become one of those. And I think if you have any appetite for this, you can do worse than going and picking up Castlevania Requiem, because it's coupled with one of the all-timers, which is Symphony of the Night. So to have these two exceptionally well-regarded game side by side is just a almost you know, just completely like irresistible package. That's probably where I would land. So yeah, strong recommend.
Very good, excellent stuff. Just remains for me, Leon, to thank Leah, Michiel, Richter, Editor Jay, our correspondents, and of course everyone of you for listening. And next time in issue 608, we talk about the computer game of the legendary Bruce Lee.